It's really a great honor to have everybody here. Just a great, great honor. And we're on page 263 in this wonderful, wonderful narrative. Vayosifu b'nei Yisrael lasot hara b'enei Adonai. Vayinem Adonai b'yad plishtim arba'im shana. And the children of Israel did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. And the Lord delivered them into the hands of Plishtim for 40 years. Now, the threat from Plishtim was different than prior threats. The word Plishtim, Philistine, what does that come from? From the word Polash. Pelamachim means to spread out. That's what it means. It means to spread out. And we find the Plishtim, of course, in the book of Genesis. And the Plishtim are arch enemies. Truly, truly arch enemies of the Jewish people. Polash and perhaps another evening we're going to go through the history of the Plishtim, but I'll tell you, they're different than the other enemies. Because the Plishtim adversary, their goal was not just to plunder, take property. Their goal was to literally destroy the Jewish people. That's the way they are presented throughout the biblical text. If we take a look, for example, at chapter 6, and we look at the threat coming from Midian. So in chapter 6, sentence 3, what are we told? This is now the threat from Midian. V'haya im zara Yisrael, page 204. And it came to pass if the Jews had sown the land, v'ala Midian v'amalek v'nekedim v'alu alav. So if we sowed land, they would come and try to destroy what we sowed. And the Midianites, they destroyed the produce of the land ad boacha Aza, until Aza. V'lo yashiru michya b'Yisrael v'seh v'shov v'chamor. That's what it talks about. It talks about how they plundered the land. But the Plishtim are different in that they really try to decimate the Jewish people. And they try to conquer the land. And we're about ready to study the story of Samson, the story of Shimshon. And he is the fourth of the major judges. And I think Irving asked, well, where were they judging? But we've gone through the story of Deborah. And that was a model of leadership where she was a judge, but she doubled up. She was also a prophetess. And then we studied the story of Gidon and also the story of Menashe, both of whom came from, Gidon and Yiftach, both of whom came from the tribe of Menashe. Yiftach comes from Gilad, Menashe on the east side of the Jordan, and they were judges, and the way they fought is they didn't fight alone. They fought with the multitudes of people. Now we're coming up to a different model, a different kind of person, and his name is Shimshon. What makes Samson different? Well, he was no prophet, and in many ways he did not judge. What makes him different? He's not like Deborah, who was a prophetess. He's not even like Gidon, and he's not like Yiftach, because when they fought with others. Samson is a fighter, and he fights alone. And we're going to read that story now. We're going to read how he was appointed. And the sad reality about Shimshon is that most of his exploits were very personal. Personal exploits, it had to do with grudges, family grudges, personal grudges. You don't have the model that you find with in the book of Judges, that the Jews were persecuted, and then the Jews, Vayitzaku, B'nai Israel, the Jews cry out to God, and God sends them a Moshiach, God sends them a Savior. You really don't have that stuff in the story of Shimshon. He's a, he he's a loner, and as we go through the narrative, we're going to see that he really is, on some level, he's out there for himself until the end of his life. The end of his life, he does something that many consider very, very heroic as a statement to save all of the Jewish people. Phil, you've got the floor.
Just a quick question.
Yes, please.
Is this occurring in what's now Gaza?
Well, you know, we're going to see exactly where this is going to be occurring. A lot of the story of Samson takes place in that area.
So the biblical roots for the Jews in Gaza really is as much as Shomron.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. The story of Abraham, for example, Abraham splits his time between Hebron, which is just south of Jerusalem, and then he travels to Beersheba, and Beersheba he goes to Gerar. He's near Aza. There's no doubt. In fact, the Torah says that he spends more time there than he does even in Hebron.
But encounters with God don't occur.
There were encounters with God.
The Jewish people and God don't encounter each other in Gaza, do they?
Oh, they do. They encounter right near Gaza. I don't know if it's in Gaza, but sure. Probably the command to go to the Akedah may have occurred there.
The main
narrative before the Akedah is dialogue with Abimelech. Abimelech is the king of Philistia. Here it is. It's in chapter 20. And it's right then, Vayiachad Varim Ha'eleh, God appears to Abram and says, take your son. It seems to be that take him from Gaza, bring him up to Jerusalem.
So not to make too much of a big deal of it, but it seems to be overlooked when you have these discussions about Gaza,
right,
that it's as much of the patrimony of the Jewish people as Hebron or right. Shechem. But it's not characterized like that. It's characterized as peripheral to the Jewish experience.
Look, there's a lot of controversy about, you know, the Midrash says that there are three cities concerning which there can be no controversy. And those are three cities that we acquired. What are those cities? Abraham bought Hebron. He bought Hebron in order to bury his wife. And then it says that Yaakov buys Nablus, he buys Shechem. That's Yaakov as soon as when he leaves Laban's home. And then we're told that David HaMelech, he buys Yerushalayim. So basically the Midrash says, there are three cities concerning which there can't be any controversy. Jerusalem, Hebron, and Shechem.
One bet.
I'm saying this is... that's what the Midrash says. And all those cities are, in a certain sense, overlooked by most of the world. They're great biblical roots.
We, the Jewish people, know that there's a history there. But in Gaza, I think it's not as clear that there's a Jewish history in Gaza.
There is a strong history. If not Aza, and not far from Aza. You know, when it says Beersheba, Gro, you're getting close. That's the southern part in biblical times. Karen?
I wanted to know what the origins of the Philistines were.
Well, we're going to study that. We're going to study that carefully another time.
Because they never mentioned before, and...
No, the Philistines are mentioned in the book of Genesis several times. And we'll go through that. The Plishtim are mentioned in chapter 21. Avimelech is mentioned chapter 20.
Yeah,
and chapter
but until 26. Now, they
haven't. Oh, no, they're plenty mentioned. We're gonna go through them. But certainly the Philistines, they come from the Aza area. There were five major cities. And here's what we're told in sentence 2. Vayhi ish echad mitzarah. There was a certain man who came from Tzarah. Okay? Mimishpachat Hadani, new tribe. He comes from the tribe of Dan. Ushmo Manoach. His name was Manoach. I like that name. Manoach comes from the word Menucha. Basically, his name was Rest. I guess after all we had been going through, he wanted some rest. Vishto Akara. And his wife was barren. Velo Yalada. And she did not bear a child. So we're told there's a man from Tzarah. He comes from the tribe of Dan, and we know his name. His wife, we don't know her name. His wife is barren. Sentence 3. Vayero Maloch Adonai El Ha'isha. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman. That's in of itself most interesting. It's more common for the angel of the Lord to appear to a man. The angel of the Lord appears to the woman, Bayoma Eleha, and says to her, Hine na'at akara, behold, now you are barren. V'lo yoladet, and you did not bear a child. But now I am here to tell you in the name of God, v'harit, that you will become pregnant, v'yoladet ben, and you will bear a son. So this angel is telling her that she is going to have a son. V'ata, and now, hishamrina, and now, be careful, because this is what you must do, or better yet, this is what you must do. V'al tishti yayin v'shecha. Do not drink wine or strong liquor. V'al tochli kol tamei, and don't eat any wrongful foods. Sometimes it's translated unclean. It's a poor translation, impure. This probably refers, not only do not drink any grapes or a wine that comes from grapes, but don't drink any extracts from the grapes. Don't touch that. Sentence 5. Ki hina chara, because behold, you are going to become pregnant. The olad ben, again he repeats, and you will have a son. Umora lo ya'ale al rosho. No razor should come upon his head. He's not to ever take a haircut. Don't shave his beard. Ki nizir Elohim yiyah ha'na'ar min avotem. Because this lad is going to be a Nazirite to God, min ha'boten, from the belly, from the womb. V'hu yochel lahushia et Yisrael miyad plishtim. And he will start to save the Jewish people from plishtim. He will start, because in the end he's not going to be, this is a prophecy, not prophecy, it's a forecast. He's not going to be totally victorious, and we know the battle against the Philistines, who was the archenemies of Saul, and for that matter David, we know that it was the Philistines. He will be the first one to do battle with the Philistines, but he's not going to be the last. So let's review this. The Malach comes to the woman and tells her, you will have a child. That's sentence 3. Sentence 4, then issues a prohibition. What does he say to her?
Don't drink any wine.
And then says, you're going to have the child in sentence 5, and make sure that he not cut his hair. So when one reads this, one wonders why. Why is he a Nazir? Why is he a Nazir? And the assumption is that if she can't drink wine, probably he can't drink wine as well. Why is he a Nazir, and what is this all about? And why does it begin? Generally, a Nazirite is a Nazirite. If one is a Nazir, I'm a Nazir relative to my own conduct. Here we're saying that not only Saul is he a Nazirite, but his mother is being told that while he is in utero, she is not to drink any wine. What is this? Why is that? Couple more sentences. Vatavo Aisha, and the woman came. Vatomer li'isha, with a dot in the hay, a mapike. And she says to her husband, that's what the second Lisha, Isha is a compound of Ishala, Lemor saying, Isha Elohim ba'ilai, a man of God came to me. Notice, by the way, she calls him a man of God. But in the text, what was he? It was a malach Hashem, it was an angel. There's a difference between being an angel and being a person. Umareu kimare malach. Ah, here he says it. But his appearance was the appearance of an angel, like an angel of Elohim of God. Nora ma'od, it was just awesome. V'lo she'iltihu emi zehu. I didn't ask him who he was. Ve'et shmo lo igidli, he also didn't tell me his name. I didn't ask him who he was, and he didn't offer me his name. Vayomeli, and he says to me, this is what she is telling Manoach. Behold, you will become pregnant and you will give birth to a son. Vata, and now, al tishti yayin v'shecha, do not drink wine or hard liquor, strong drink. Va'al tochli kol tuma, don't consume any extracts of that stuff. Don't eat any inappropriate foods. Ki nizir Elohim yihanar, because this lad is going to be a Nazirite to the Lord. Min ha'beten, Ajiomoto, from the womb until the day he dies. Seek, stop. First question. I want to take the floor and ask you the first question. The angel of the Lord appears to this woman and says to the woman, yada, yada, yada. The woman then turns around and tells Manoach what the angel of the Lord said. Whenever you see that in the text, we have a rule of thumb. What must we do?
Compare.
We must compare. Saul hit it right on the head. So when Eliezer comes to that well because he's looking for a wife for Yitzhak, he says whatever he says. The woman who was going to do this and going to do that, this is the woman who was worthy. And then he gets to the house of Rivka, and what does he do? He tells the story again. If he's going to tell the story again, the Torah is quite brief when it comes to words. It tries to speak in as brief a manner as possible. If it's going to be lengthening out the text and going to be repeating it, so the astute reader is always asking, I want to compare the two. What are the differences between the two? And I leave it open. I'll start you off. For example, let's take a look at what we're really doing is we're comparing sentence 3, 4, and 5. 3, 4, and 5 is what the angel of the Lord says to the woman. And she repeats it in sentence 7. So we're comparing 3, 4, and 5 to sentence 7. I'll open it up. I'll be the first batter. In sentence 3, the angel of the Lord says to her, behold, you are barren and have not given birth. Does she repeat that?
No.
How? She does not. In sentence 7, she does not. She does repeat the end of sentence 3, that he told me, behold, you are going to become pregnant and give birth. Why does she not repeat, behold? Why does she not repeat that he tells her, behold, you are barren?
The first part's not news.
It's not news.
It's obvious.
It's obvious. It's obvious to... It's obvious to...
She knows, and her husband knows.
She knows, and her husband knows.
Maybe she didn't want to make it a definite to her husband. Maybe she wanted to keep the idea of definitive barrenness away from her husband. That it
she
diminishes
didn't want,
her in
right,
his eyes.
Maybe it would diminish her once she would declare, behold, I am barren. So, interesting. That phrase is missing from the text. Let's go on.
Self-condemnation.
Let's go on a little bit further. And then in sentence 4, in sentence 3 it says, and behold, you will become pregnant and have a son. Is this repeated?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Now in sentence 4 he says, watch yourself, don't drink wine or strong drink. Right? Is this repeated?
Yes.
It is repeated. And do not eat any extracts. Is this repeated? Yes. Let's continue sentence 5. Behold, you are pregnant, you will have a son, that's there. Umora lo ya'ale arosho. And no razor shall go upon his head. Is that repeated?
No.
It's nowhere here. Why not? You follow what we're doing? We're comparing the text. This angel had said to him, Umora lo ya'ale arosho. And what I'd like to know is why does she omit this phrase that no razor, umora lo ya'ale arosho? What's the exact translation? Let's take a look at it in sentence 5. And no razor shall come upon his head. Why is it not repeated?
Well, it's known a Nazareth doesn't shave. It's supposed to be that way.
Excellent. So from that perspective, Rebbe, in that perspective, Florence, she does say to him, behold, he said, I'll become pregnant and have a son. Now, don't drink wine or strong drink. Don't eat the extracts. You then have the phrase, Ki Nizir Elohim. This child is going to be a Nazirite of God. So it could be that in the phrase, Ki Nizir, as Florence is saying, that in the phrase, Ki Nizir Elohim, it is understood that Mora Lo Ya'ale Arosho. And that really is an approach. It's the approach of the Malbim. 19th century Russian Jewish commentary makes the point that in fact she does say Umora lo ya'ale arosho, but she says it more succinctly in saying that he will be a Nazirite. That is understood. Everybody understands that a Nazirite would not have a razor upon his head. Is there any other possibility as to why, taking it from the perspective that Kinazir is not enough, she doesn't explicitly say, Umoro lo ya'ale arosho? What is this about?
Maybe things change in life.
Maybe things change in life. So what does that mean? That things change in...
That as this child grows up, maybe the idea of being a Nazirite would be a negative thing in terms of historic... importance.
Yes?
I'm not so sure she's so keen on this whole idea. Because she leaves out the most important part, that he's going to begin to save Israel from the Philistines. Mm-hmm.
She may just have been so happy at the thought of having a child that she didn't want to complicate anything in the eyes of her husband and just keep it as simple as possible.
Great. We're saying great things. So Saul is saying that, Saul points out that in sentence 5, the angel did say, and he will start saving the Jewish people from the Philistines. She has left that out. And so she's what? She's...
Well, she wants the baby, but I don't know that she's so happy to learn that
she's protected.
All this is going to happen and he's not going to be a normal child.
Right.
Well, a Nazareth is...
So actually, Saul has raised yet another point. We have that adds to our question. Now we have two questions. Our first question is, she doesn't mention explicitly that a razor should not come on his head, although we said maybe, as Warren said, it's King Zero Lokim. The second piece is, she does not repeat to him that he will begin to save the Jewish people. That's a second piece. We've got to try to understand that. Yes, Phil?
It's not locking herself in. In other words, if it's a man of God, it's a pretty strong sort of suggestion.
Yes, it is. So if what? If he
said... Well, by not verbalizing it, she's pulling back from committing to...
Uh-huh.
Telling her husband that, look, basically God said this is what we got to do.
Right.
Maybe she's more looking at the child as just a child, not in terms of the destiny of the Jewish people.
Ah, and you think that although she's been told this, by not telling it to her husband, she's not bought into what the angel of the Lord has said?
Not so much that she's not bought into it, but she's not making explicit with her husband a commandment of God. She's withholding from her husband.
And why? Why would she
maybe
not?
She's reluctant. She's
why?
Reluctant.
She's reluctant.
Because she looks at it as a baby that she's happy to have, not as something she has to give up to God. To give up to God.
So we're now focusing now on Saul's question.
Right.
She's omitted one of the key things. Because the angel of the Lord, the Malach Hashem, says, and he will begin, he will be the person who will save the Jewish people. V'hu yachel, if you take a look in sentence 5, v'hu yachel oshiat Israel miyad plishtim. And he will begin to save Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. And what you're arguing is that she doesn't repeat this because she's reluctant.
Reluctant to accept the burden of this awesome burden.
She's reluctant to accept this awesome burden.
The word begin may insinuate he'll only begin. He may not finish. He may die. Now, I think it means that this child is not hers, that it's a child on loan, that she's just a vessel carrying this child, that it's not... doesn't make this child her personal child. That this is someone that she's on a mission to bear this child for a supreme command.
Virgin Mary.
Right.
Right. Well, do we have an example of
that? She's just.
Do we have an example of a woman who was barren?
Sure.
And of course, a woman who was barren and has a child and says, "If I have a child, I will give this child to the Lord." That's, of course, Hannah. Hannah has Shmuel. And although it's a story that occurs afterwards, it was not so simple. It was not so simple. And interestingly enough, as Hannah was praying, she was babbling, and Eli, the Kohen, actually thinks that she's drunk. And here, of course, she's being told, make sure not to drink. But what I'm hearing is, she doesn't say, and he will begin saving the Jewish people, because maybe she's reluctant. She's a vessel, begin, or as you were saying, to have a child and to say that this child is going to save the Jewish people, you're really kind of saying, this child is, it's like a... It's like a mother sending a child into the front lines, and who knows what's going to happen to this child. I would add, by the way, that if she repeats to her husband that this is what the angel said, that he's going to save the Jewish people, you know, once you tell another person, you know when a secret remains a secret? When one of the two people involved in a secret dies. Until that point, you can be sure the secret's going to get out. So once she tells this to her husband, someone's going to find out about it. Now, if the word gets out, you know, on YouTube, or whatever it is, that she had told Manoach that he is going to save the, I'm going to become pregnant and he's going to save the Philistine people, I think it's the Abraham Benel, one of the commentators say, who's in trouble?
He.
She's in trouble. You're right, he's in trouble for sure. But he's in trouble while she's pregnant. If people are going to know that she is pregnant, that she's going to be, and she is carrying the Savior of the Jewish people, Dach, because she is carrying the person who's going to save Am Yisrael, she'd rather keep that to herself, say some of the commentators, to save her own self. And beyond that, as you're beautifully saying, and I've not seen this in any of the commentators, but I've just said by some of the commentators, but your comment is wonderful, and that is that she hears the mission. It's something that, in the end, she's going to have to accept, but it's tough. It's tough for a mother to say, hey, v'hu yachel, and he's going to start saving the Jewish people. I mean, saving the Jewish people has its risks. It has some very, very serious risks. I remember once talking about how Rav Kook used to, in his Bekesha on Friday nights, when he would sing Shalom Aleichem to the angels, he would say, Shalom Aleichem Alechei Asharit, welcome angels. And then, Voachem L'Shalom, come in peace, you angels. Baruchuni L'Shalom, bless me in peace. And then we'd say, Tzeitchem L'Shalom, go in peace. So there's a story about the saintly Rabbi Kook in his Bekesha's long black coat, the old beard, big hat. He'd go to the door and he'd wave bye-bye. He'd wave bye-bye to the angel. Imagine the great Rabbi Kook. And I told this to our kids, and our kids said, ah, but that's not enough. And they went on strike, and they refused for many, many months, even years, to sing Tzeitchem L'Shalom. They said, listen, if the angels are coming, we say hello to the angels. Oh, we're not going to turn around and say goodbye to the angels. We want the angels to remain. So I shared in front of the shul that there is a teaching of Rav Nachman in Bratslav that the angels on Friday night are our children. One is blessed with children. Every Friday night we say hello to the children. May the children be welcome. May the children be blessed. And what we say is every Friday night when our children leave our homes, may they leave in peace. May they leave when they're 19 or 20 with the message of Shabbat. And so we stand at the door and wave goodbye. And Daniela Grunfeld, Rafi's wife, said that resonated with her. And she told me that when her children were very young and she put them on the bus to go to school, to go to SAR, all the mothers would turn to them, to their children, and wave bye-bye. And Daniela said that when she waved bye-bye, she didn't go this way, she went this way. She loved the children so much, she didn't want them to say, she didn't want them to leave.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's goodbye, come close. Wait, but the point is, take it for what it's worth. What it really means is that little story is a mother who doesn't want to let her children go and says, I love you so much, I know I got to let you go. But my goodbye is, may you always, always remain close. And in a similar fashion, here in the book of Judges, it's hard for a mother to say, hey, and my son is going to save the Jewish people, because you know what this means. You know, our children now are living in Ephrat, Ilana and Mikey, and they have seven children, six boys, and I can tell the world now, because the world knows that Ilana is, thank God, expecting her eighth, B'Shah Tova Mutzlachat. Six boys and one girl, I get a little concerned. You know, in Israel, you have boys, you know what they're going to do. And every time I see the boys, I sit with them and I say, well, because one of them is 15 already, and start asking them about the army, and I thought the army would be very tough for them. And the last time I saw Gilad, I said, Gilad, what do you think about the army? It's just a few years away. He says, look, I'm Sabi, someone has to defend the state of Israel. So I was davening with him on Friday night. We were on a hill in Yerushalayim. And he's looking out. You sure be blessed with such a story. We're looking out on the hills of Jerusalem. And this little Gilad, he's all 15 years old of him. He turns to me and says, Sabi, Avi, look at you, Yerushalayim. Someone has to defend Yerushalayim. It's my honor. I'll make a small contribution, he said in his own 15-year-old way. It's very beautiful. It really brought tears to my eyes. But it's not so easy for mothers, you know, here in America, we don't feel that. It's not so easy for mothers, let alone fathers, it's not so easy to say, I let you go, and you're going to go out there in the field, and war is tough. You heard this past Shabbat, I got up there and spoke about Mayan Ruttenberg, who lost his life. It was a training exercise. He got caught between the gun, the big gun on the tank, and the tank. It's serious, serious business. She can't, as much as she knows this is part of her fate, she can't say it. And maybe that's why she doesn't say it. Yes, Charles?
It occurs to me that so many important, significant characters and personalities come from women who were barren and was told by God they will have children.
That's right.
Does this suggest that God somehow involves himself in the conceptions? Is the suggestion made that God? I'm not thinking of a virgin birth particularly. A normal birth, but that somehow God plays a greater part in this than in others?
Well, there really is a thinking that God, that we are products of course, the conception, that is to say, a relationship between our respective mothers and fathers, but that God is a partner in terms of the miracle of creation. You find it in the first physical creation of
humanity. I'm thinking more than just the fact that there's a God in all of this.
In general, there is a Jewish belief that there are three partners in creation. Mother, Father, and God. In the beginning of chapter 4 of Perek Daled in Sefer Breshit, the Torah says, V'adam yada et chava ishto. And Adam knew his wife Eve. That means yada means love. They had relations. Vatar vatele did kain. And she gives birth to Cain. Vatomen, she says, kaniti ish et Hashem. I've given birth to this child with the help of the Lord. There is this sense that God is the third partner in creation. But again, you're right, Charles, that there is a lot of discussion of women being barren. And somehow, from women being barren, there have been great things that have happened. Maybe what it teaches is that there could be that challenge, but Lepum Tzara Agra, it's hard to say. I mean, the Torah goes out of its way. When you think about the matriarchs, Sarah was barren. Rebecca had problems conceiving. Rachel has problems conceiving. Only Leah doesn't. And the Torah goes out of its way to explain why she didn't have problems conceiving. Precisely because she wasn't so much liked by Jacob. Oh, she gives birth quickly. So there is something to that, Charles. There is stuff that happens from, we should all be spared from it, because it's a real, real issue. I used to get up on Rosh Hashanah and always talk about Hannah was barren and so on and so forth, until I grew up as a rabbi and I realized that there are always women and men in the crowd who, by the way, couldn't have children, didn't have children, and so one has to be very, very careful. One out of six couples can't have children. One out of 12 people can't have children. So this is not such a simple matter. It's something I feel very, very strongly. There are people who are not blessed with children. We have to be sensitive, very sensitive to that. I was thinking the other day of, there's men and women may, but women, but men should wear a talit. I actually was thinking there are many men without children. Now, there is a tradition that men wear a talis only when they're married. But I'm thinking that means that for some men, they'll never wear a talis. And there's something to wearing a talis. And indeed, there is a lot of halacha that says that men should wear a talis from their bar mitzvah. It's very, very common in Eretz Yisrael, especially. And I think it's something I want to talk about. I want to encourage men, whether married or unmarried, certainly as we get older, to wear a talit. I think it's an important thing. Let me move to the last question. The last question is, why doesn't she say to Manoach that he said to me, that no razor should go on his head. And I want to offer this suggestion. It's not mine. I believe it's said by the Barak Bunnell. And what he says is as follows. You know, there's a real peace happening here in that the angel of the Lord came to her and not to him. It's very, very interesting. When Sarah was barren, Rav Pesach, to whom do the angels go and reveal that the child is going to be born?
To
Abraham. Sarah's in the background. Here it's in the reverse. Could it be that she knows history? And she knows most of the time to whom does the angel appear? To the male party. And now she wants to soften the blow to him. Yeah. So the angel says to her stuff like, hey, don't drink wine. And when you have the child, make sure that no razor goes on his head. Now, she says, you know something? I just, in talking to my husband, I don't want to hurt him too much. After all, she understands that Manoach may be wondering, and you see it later on, because Manoach, in the next few sentences, says, "Hey, come on, we've got, you know, I'd like to see this angel come to us." And by the way, who does the angel come to again? Comes to her, and what does she do? She runs to tell Manoach. So, what this commentator says, what the Abravanel says, is she's only, this is really, it shows a certain human sensitivity, Charles. She says only to him, only the stuff that applies to her. So she says to him, you know what, the angel came to me. You know why he came to me? I'm filling in the pieces. Don't feel bad, my husband. She came to me because he wanted to tell me a couple of things. Things like, what, don't drink wine. That has nothing to do with the child now. I mean, I can't drink wine from the time I conceive. I can't drink wine. But she doesn't talk about that razor should no razor should go on his head, because once she does that, then that is a mandate that doesn't apply to her, it applies to the child. Well, that just as well could have been told
to him.
So I want you to get a sense of what happens when this stuff is shared by the angel to the wife of Manoach, and then she repeats it, and the stuff that she says, she doesn't say. In fact, the commentators go out of their way and note that she adds something that was never told to her. She says, "Ki nizir," in sentence 7, "Ki nizir Elohim yeh ana min habeten ad yom moto." This child is going to be a Nazirite until he dies. Right. Was he a Nazirite until he died?
No.
We all know that his hair was cut. And by the way, he adds this, and the angel never said that. All the angel said was, "Ki nizir Elohim yeh ana min habaten." I mean, she's unaware. The reason why the angel doesn't say until the day he died, because the angel probably knows what's going to happen, that he would not remain a Nazirite until the end. She doesn't have that information, and so she assumes that that's what it is all about. Stop, I'll take your thoughts, your comments on just that little...
What was the significance?
Little interlude.
What was the significance of his having long hair and a beard untrimmed?
Right, now I want to talk about that. Now I want to understand that. I want to know... Here's the question I want to deal with. The question I want to deal with, and we're going to move through the story of Shimshon pretty quickly, so I want you to, if you have a chance to read it through the next week, it's fast reading, next four chapters. I want to know what this is all about. Why is it important that he become a Nazir? He can't drink, he can't shave, a razor can't go on his... Why is that? What is this all about?
Being devoted to God and being pure. And
Being devoted to God, being
but
pure.
Why did that mean he could had to be impure if he shaved?
Right.
There are pure people throughout the Bible who shaved and cut their hair.
That's true. Most people around this table have cut their hair and are pretty pure. What do you have to not... Yeah.
But it's sort of a constant... you're dedicated to God. It's a little like the Zazel. going into Yom Rosh Hashanah, they send the scapegoat into a valley that hasn't been plowed. Again, it's like hair that hasn't been cut. It's a certain level of a consecration.
Good. I want to ask the question this way. Is becoming a Nazirite good or not? Is it a good thing for one to declare, I wish to become a Nazirite? Yeah. Is it good or not?
It's not a good thing.
Why is he a good thing? Excellent. Why? Rabbi Pesach says it's not a good thing. He's a sinner. Why is he a sinner?
Because he deprives himself of life.
He deprives himself of life. What's the story they tell about Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, the great rabbi who spent day and night studying Torah? Never took a vacation. One day he decides, he goes to the Alps. This is unheard of. Shamshon Raphael Hirsch should go to the Alps. He lived in the 19th century. Comes back from his vacation, and people were just astounded. He went to the Alps. And somebody comes up to him and says, Rabbi Hirsch, you went on vacation, you went to the Alps. How come? And he very famously responded, he says, you know, I was afraid, I'm getting a bit older, after I die, I was afraid that one day God would come up to me and say, Shamshon, you never enjoyed my Alps. You never enjoyed my Alps. I had to get up there.
You should say the Alps are nice.
Right? So what Reb Pesach is saying is, to become a Nazirite, that person is a chote. You're a sinner because you're depriving yourself of the world that God has given us to appreciate.
I don't think it makes you a sinner. I think it made him someone who didn't experience what other people had experienced, and it sets you apart.
Uh-huh.
It makes you a stranger among men.
Being a Nazirite makes
yes,
you a stranger.
Yes, not a sinner.
Good.
Like a sort of priest-like, you know, trying to attain a higher level of spirituality.
Right. Actually, a Nazirite has aspects of being a priest. Which aspect, especially?
Not drinking.
Well, I'm sorry?
Not drinking.
Yeah, well, I mean, a Kohen Gadol, some, at times, certainly, in the service. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Or a Nazirite is not supposed to have contact, not supposed to have avi contact with the dead. In a certain sense, one can look at a Nazirite as being a voluntary Kohen.
A Kohen,
super Kohen. Priest-like reverberation.
Right, what's the famous rabbinic of Rabbi Rachman used to always tell the story about the guy who wanted to be a Kohen?
Yeah.
Right?
Like his father was.
Right.
Like his father was.
So,
like it was in a pay for it.
I, as a Kohen, I wouldn't wish it on anyone because there are times, like when I, Avi, I so much wanted you to be with you and you were... you became an avil. I couldn't go in. I'm behind a glass. That's what it is. We just had a situation where a young couple in the shul had a stillborn child. They knew that the fetus was dead. So until the fetus emerges, I could be in the room, even as a kohen. Once the fetus emerges, I can't be there. And I come late to the hospital, the fetus had just emerged, and I so much wanted to be with them, couldn't be with them. It's a very, very difficult, for me personally, it's a very, very difficult time. The Kohen is not supposed to have contact with the dead, neither is a Nazirite. But we're back to our question, is it a good thing for one to say, I want to be a Nazirite? I want to be in a situation where I don't have contact with the dead, I want to be in a situation where I let my hair grow, I want to be in a situation where I don't consume any wine. Yes, sir. What do you think?
No, and I think this is what confounds me about this whole story, that he's supposed to be a spiritual and pure person, and he's not. Maybe in the end, he redeems himself. In life, he's not. No. So he's supposed to be a Nazirite, but he seems anything but.
He seems everything but a pure person.
Yes,
Charles.
I have a question.
Excellent.
That is, if, because his hair was cut under protest, why does that take away his Nazirite relationship? If you are in a room where somebody dies, does that make you not a Kohen anymore?
But he was the one who volunteered to Delilah, cut my hair.
He just told her that his strength came from him.
Okay, well, he knew what that would mean. He knew because there had been events beforehand where he fibbed to her and he told her, this is my strength, and he put on the ropes, the wet ropes, the unused ropes, all that stuff. He knew what would happen, and in that sense, he in a certain sense, he was complicit. Let's take a look at what the
taken away from him, but the angel said that it should not be taken away from him because the angel said he will die as a Nazarite.
The angel, no, actually, she said.
She said.
She said until the day of his death. The angel didn't say that. The angel may have known what would be Pesach.
I think if he had Torah, now he has to bring a korban too. Yes.
And what kind of korban? Korban chatat. Korban chatat. So Reb Pesach says that we know that after somebody says I want to be a Nazirite, and after the period of being a Nazirite, the Nazir has to bring a Korban Chatat, has to bring a sin offering. What is he bringing? Why is he bringing a sin offering? Let's take quickly two views. This is the work of Nechama Leibovich. She quotes the two major views. I'm on page 56, the bottom left. If you see 56, then you know on your right. Let's take it from the first paragraph. If man, David, you want to take it? If man should argue.
Yeah.
He should argue, since envy, passion, and pride are evil, then shall I divorce and separate myself utterly from them till I eat no meat, nor drink wine, nor marry, nor reside in a comfortable dwelling, nor wear fine clothes, but only wool and sackcloth, after the manner of the heathen priests.
In other words, he's saying that since envy and passion and pride are evil, you know what? I'll tell you how I'm going to deal with this. I'm going to separate myself from all of this. I am going to make up my mind that I'm not going to become involved in any worldly pleasure. I'm going to sit in sackcloth like the heathen priests, because the heathen priests, how did they attain spirituality? By denying physicality. You deny the body. The gateway to spirituality, the gateway to sublimating the soul, is you deny yourself physical pursuits, physical pleasures. And says, this is now, by the way, this is the writing of Maimonides in Hilchot Deot, the third chapter. What does he say? This also, go on.
This also is an evil path, and forbidden it is to walk therein, as is stated in the case of the...
And he quotes a prior source. He says, this is forbidden. Therefore, our sages commanded man to deny himself only things denied him by the Torah. He should not inflict on himself vows or herself. Vows of abstinence on things permitted him. Thus our sage had stated, it is not sufficient for you that which the Torah has forbidden. There are not enough prohibitions, but you go ahead and you forbid other things unto yourself as well. This includes those who are given to fasting. Our sages forbade a man to mortify himself with fasting. To such things King Solomon referred when he counseled, be not righteous over much, al titzdak harbe, neither make thyself overly wise, why shouldest thou destroy thyself? So according to Rambam, this is what Pesach said, it is inappropriate for one to become a Nazirite. Why is it inappropriate for one to become a Nazirite? God permitted us certain things. Why are we doing that?
But also, is it appropriate to become super firm? Crazy firm.
Well, that's okay. Lately I have said that the bayit should be alcohol free. And I've been criticized for that. People are saying, what are you doing? The Torah permits drinking, and it's correct. And there is a solid argument to that, that we're not supposed to forbid upon ourselves more than Lord knows that there's enough that we can't do, and now should we add to it that there's other stuff that we're not celibates. This is not what the Torah is about. The Torah doesn't talk about people denying themselves the pleasure and the celebration of marriage. And I guess the reason why, so why is it, Rav Pesach, that after a person is a nazir, that he offers a korban chatat? He offers a korban chatat, a sin offering, to atone for the wrong of having become a Nazirite. He's offering a korban chatat for having entered into this whole Nazirite stuff. Now, this is the position of Rambam. Now let us read the position of Nachmanides, the position of Ramban. It's going to be the next. It's going to be starting with the second line. Nachmanides takes a wholly different attitude in this matter. Poles apart from the middle natural way advocated by Maimonides. Commenting on the Nazarite's need to bring a sin offering, Nachmanides adheres to the plain sense of the scriptures, stating that. Now let's see what he says. Do you see page 56? The quote, two paragraphs from the bottom. See page 56? Two paragraphs from the bottom. Do you want to take it? This man sins. Okay. Anybody want to take it there? Phil, do you want to take it? This man
sins against himself when he forsakes his vows of abstinence. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, he has separated himself to be holy unto the Lord, and by rights he should always continue to live a life of holiness and separation to God, in accordance with the verse, "And I raised up your sons for prophets, and of your young men for Nazarites," Amos 2:11. There the Nazarite is equated to the prophet. Similarly, the Torah states, "All the days of his separation shall be holy unto the Lord." Now that he returns to defile himself with worldly passions.
Now this is the flip opposite. This is 180 degrees in the opposite direction. What is Nachmanides saying? Nachmanides is arguing that it is good to become a Nazirite.
You think it's good to be excessive?
Well,
he's saying the more zealous and the more carried away, the best goal is the purest, most fierce faith and observance.
Well, he's saying, right, you're right, but he's saying as we're looking at the narrow definition of a Nazirite, not drinking, and he's saying the more one denies physicality, the holier, the more holy. It's not the middle ground, right? The more holy one becomes.
But
now there's a different way. Becoming a Nazirite, that is the reality. Is that is going to be a status for a select few of the Jewish people. He is not claiming that this is normative Judaism. He's saying for those people who believe that by abstaining they can reach a higher level, for those people, there are not many of them, those people are to be applauded. It's the opposite of Maimonides. See, Maimonides is a rationalist. And as a rational thinker, he says, I look at the world, and the way one achieves holiness in the world is not by denying one's body, not by denying physicality, says Maimonides, but rather by taking the physical and giving it spiritual meaning, religious meaning. But Maimonides would argue that I've got to see the ops. That if the Torah permits me to drink, I'm allowed to drink. I'm allowed to indulge and enjoy the beauty of the world at the right time, with the right person, in the right place. That is the position of Maimonides. Nachmanides is the mystic Kabbalist. He says, no, for those individuals who think that they can achieve a higher spiritual plane by denying their body, for those particular individuals, bivakasha. So the way we'd have to understand this is as follows, that after the period of one becoming a Nazirite, the Torah says you give a sin offering. For Maimonides, you know why you give a sin offering? For Maimonides, you give a sin offering to show that you regret having become a Nazirite. For Nachmanides, the reason why you give the sin offering is, why is it? Because you've forsaken being a Nazirite. It's in the next paragraph. Look at Nechama's explanation. How wide indeed is the chasm that separates Maimonides' approach from Nachmanides? Maimonides regards the very act of becoming a Nazarite as a sin. Nachmanides, the act of forsaking the Nazarite vow. That is the sin. So my question now as we end this shiur is, what about Samson? What about Shimshon? How does it fit in? What fits in? Why does he become a Nazarite?
He was Nazir Elohim, he could not do nothing.
He was against his will at all. His whole life was against his will. Nazir Elohim, he could do nothing. He was forced to do what he told him. Right. But, I mean,
but why does God want him to become a Nazir? I don't know. Maybe there's no one else
around. Why does God want him to become a Nazir? We've just now gone through two positions. One position is that to become a Nazir is a good thing. That's Nachmanides. According to Maimonides, it's a bad thing.
Is it that his strength lay in his negating all worldly pleasures so that he could become a deliverer and that achieve loss of will, loss of humanness in reaching a higher plane so that he could have a mission?
Right, and I hear that, but there are deliverers who live a normal physical life.
What he had to do, he had to reach that.
What makes him different? We've put forth two different positions. Whether it is sinful to become a Nazarite or not. Nachmanides, again I'm repeating, says it is sinful. Excuse me, Maimonides says that it's a sinful. Nachmanides says no. But what makes Samson the average Joe in the street? What makes him different, Hal?
He's got strength.
Maybe it's a little like this Confucianism. It's partly mind. Your mind has to be with your body to get the super strength. So you have to clear your mind. By clearing your mind, you clear your mind of drink.
Here's my sense of it. My sense is that we've presented two views on being a Nazarite, and I hear that. And the question is whether one achieves higher spiritual levels by denying the body, or the option is there the higher spiritual level by sanctifying the body, sublimating the body. I think Samson, however, is almost a separate category.
He didn't become a Nazarite. He was born a Nazarite.
But God wants him to be a Nazarite.
He wasn't born a Nazarite.
Let's understand something. God wants him to become a Nazarite. We must assume that the Malach is... So why would God... I mean, from Nachmanides' position, okay, but from the position of Maimonides, why would God want him to be a Nazarite?
Nazarite is a higher position.
According to Nachmanides, but according to Rambam,
because he lacks
a higher position.
It's a higher position.
He lacks the characteristics which being a Nazarite will bring to him. So it's he's incomplete. So he doesn't have enough. Whatever being a Nazarite will.
What he was meant to accomplish.
Yes.
He would have to have.
Why?
Self-control.
Why? But my question is, why couldn't he have self-control by drinking a little bit, by shaving every third day? Now, one second. That's a very important point. His nature. Now we're coming down to what's making Shimshon very unique. He's no Devorah. He's no Gidon. He's no Yiftach. We're talking about a one-man army. We're talking about, this is a powerful force. He doesn't need tanks. He doesn't need planes. He's the Superman, Lahavdil. He is full. When we think of physicality in the Bible, what do we think about? We think about Samson. Could he be the kind of person whose physicality was such that he was prone? His physicality was so powerful that if he were to touch even the smallest glass of wine, which would be permitted, he would just spiral out of control. There are such people, as we know, alcoholics, Think about an alcoholic. It's very, very well known that if one is an alcoholic, if one has a netiya, and I'm sure there are people who from birth, by the way, in utero, they become, literally in utero, they become accustomed to a certain way. Through whatever it is, there are people who can't touch wine, because once they touch wine, they're not going to be able to control themselves. I know if I'm going to take one cigarette, if I've been a chain smoker, I'm not going to be able to control myself. If I've been playing cards and if I'm a gambler, I better watch myself. If I have to watch the food that I eat, well, the worst thing one can do is cheat a little bit on that diet. Once I cheat a little bit on the diet, for some people, for most people, it's easy to control. But for some people, they can't control. Is it possible that separate from what we've spoken about, Maimonides and Nachmanides, that the angel says to Samson, you have got to be a Nazir, because you've got to understand that you are going to be blessed with certain characteristics, certain physical strengths. But all strengths have their challenges. And the challenge that your strength has is that if left uncontrolled, you can literally go wild. And could it be that he's asked to be a Nazirite to abstain as a kind of counterbalance to that natural physicality? Is that possible? Is that the reason? Is that the reason why he is told it's to become, as commentators say, a spiritual break? That's the language that they use. A spiritual break to his unusual strength. I mean, they talk about other stuff. They talk about maybe it's important for Samson not to drink so that he not be Philistine-like. The Philistines used to drink, therefore don't drink so that you not be like a Philistine. Or they talk about maybe he's not supposed to shave or take a haircut because the Philistines persecuted the Jewish people, and this is a way that Samson was showing that he was mourning. Or maybe they did it, don't drink, because he did such abnormal things that if he were drinking, people will say he did it not because he was thinking consciously, but because he was drunk. There are all of those observations. But I think the major observation is, don't drink, because that is the way you can counterbalance your tremendous, tremendous physical strength. And I want to read it inside. Let's take a look at what the Midrashei HaTorah says, what Solomon Asterix says. Yes, please, Pesach.
Parents put their son to a Jew.
Without his will. Let me ask it from here, it seems. Yes, can a parent, Pesach, let me ask a klutz kasha, can a parent put a child to becoming a Kohen? I'm saying, though, that absolutely. It's Shayashuv Cohen's father. Absolutely. I'm saying there are certain things that we give to our children, whether they want it or not. Can a parent give to a child the responsibility of becoming a Nazir? Here it happened. He Nazir Elokim. Absolutely. It's like the Nobel Prize winner this Shabbat, man. When you win the Nobel Prize, you can say what you want, and it's going to be good, no matter what you say. Let's take a look at this third comment on the right-hand side. This is now Solomon Asterix. He writes, for the fact that his passions got the better of him, till he was driven to abstain from wine to subdue his material desires and bodily wants and deny himself the legitimate enjoyment of wine that makes glad both God and man. According to the latter opinion, the sin is not in becoming a Nazirite or in ceasing to be one. That's Maimonides and Nachmanides. The sin referred to concerns that which preceded the Nazirite vow. Previous inability to control and discipline his desires within the bounds imposed by the Torah had made it necessary for the person concerned to restrict himself even further and vow himself to abstinence. The Nazirite vow was thus a necessary but extreme medicine for spiritual ills. That is Shimshon.
Or could have been
I'm sorry?
By
the way, it may have been it. Absolutely. Maybe he got it from his mother. But it was precisely, the sin was that you're apt to do this kind of thing and you require. I mean, you know, why have I asked that the shul be drinking free? I mean, I'm no, you know,
I'm no fool. Well, why have I done this? I know what the Torah says. Yeah, because when you sit down with kids, as I sit down with kids from the shul, and they are locked into drinking or into substance abuse, and they say that part of it they learned from Kiddush clubs, it makes me think that for a while I've got to go to the opposite end. I've got to go to the opposite end to counterbalance it. Maybe the time will come when we can allow it. But, you know, if I'm going to see people drinking, who knows where they're drinking, you know, something has to be done about it. And I think this is what Solomon Asterik is saying. This is what Moshe Torah is saying. It's saying that he was so prone. Maybe it was his mother, Avi. He was so prone to that he required that kind of spiritual break. Now, the irony about it is that it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. He still goes after women, right? He's still out of control on so many different occasions. That's the irony. As much as they tried for this to be the spiritual counterbalance, it doesn't seem, certainly in the life of Shimshon, it doesn't help. It only helps to the extent that at the end, he's able to do something which is considered quite noble, although there's a lot of discussion as to whether he had a right to kill himself. In effect, he says, as the Philistines die, let me die as well. There's a lot of questions whether, in effect, he took his life, whether one is permitted to do that. Yes, Saul?
Well, all I was going to say was the very first thing we see is he's a woman and he runs to his parents and says, I want
to. That's right. That's correct.
That tells you his character at the outset. Right.
I'm saying the irony is that with all they tried to do to balance out that penchant to the physical, he's still out of control.
Well, why did God choose him in the first place?
It's a different form of leadership. And look, I don't know, who knows what God's ways are. Only God understands his ways. But what we find in Tanakh are different forms of leadership. And we've had in the book of Judges, we've had Deborah, who was a prophetess. We've had Gidon and Yiftach, they were judges. And then here you have Samson, and he's fighting against the Plishtim, were a physical force. They were military might with tremendous arms. And maybe the thought was, let's get someone who, even as the Philistines were stripping us of arms, find this throughout Tanakh, he doesn't need any armor. He doesn't need any arms. He's powerful enough to do it on his own. Whereas all the others maybe were speaking in the name of God, in the spirit of God, the way he speaks is with the strength of God. And frankly, it's going to be a model of leadership, Estelle, that will fail. It is yet another model of leadership that will fail. I know that Steinsaltz got into trouble when he wrote that, I think his language was that Shimshon was a thug. Got into a lot of trouble, but let me tell you.
He
not because he wanted to.
Was it expecting too much of him? Was it something that he could not?
I was once in shul. I was in England, and I read something that somebody was criticizing some rabbi, put him in cherem. But I was running in for mincha. I walk out of mincha. I looked up. It was me. I don't know what I did, but I heard about it, and that's the way it goes. You know you've made it if you've been put in Clarence.
This is crazy. Every time they talk about him, it's the basis of Christianity.
Why?
Whatever Nachmanides said, you know, if you reach a higher form of celibacy and purity and everything else, this is the way they believe.
No, but wait. Yeah, I would say I think I hear that. I think the difference is that for Nachmanides, I don't think Nachmanides is projecting this to be what the average person should aspire for. For those select few, b'vakasha, I think Christianity is really saying that that is an ideal for everyone. But yeah, that's what Nachmanides says.
Sort of as an aside, the angel knows what's going to happen to Shimshon in the end. That means that everything is like, that means there's no free will. What's the Jewish position on that? I mean, are there two different ideas going on there?
That's great. Another course, another time. I got enough trouble here. David, and then Saul, we're going to stop. Yes.
Yeah. It seems that there are two different issues here. It's
talking about a child who's a Nozir from birth, as opposed to somebody else who might want to become a Nozir later on.
Right.
So there's two things going on here, and I don't think the answer is the same for both, because mm-hmm. Hashem obviously had wanted Shimshon to be a Nozir from birth, and we're trying to assume from that that it's not that it isn't a desirable thing to do on your own.
Right. Now, what I am saying that the case of Shimshon is, I'm saying something very close to that, that the case, if not that, the case of Shimshon is different than normative Nazirut. The question of whether it's good, it's not good, what's the best way to serving God, it's different than Shimshon, because Shimshon was an unusual character. What made him unusual is he was prone to a physical dynamic that was different than the average human being. There was something about his prowess. It's different than anyone sitting around this table. And therefore, it was very, very critical that something, this was the model of leadership. We want to get somebody very powerful. But to those who are very, very powerful, we want to put on the brakes. And the way the ethics of power was being suggested for Samson was that physicality be limited, the language being it be a spiritual bent. I think you're right. You can't, from the story of Samson, make conclusions about the average person who doesn't have, I think you're right, who doesn't have that physical strength. And again, the irony is that even that for Samson, it was clearly not enough. Yes.
So I never thought of this before, but maybe if this is partly a story of the failure of leadership and group strength.
Yes, it
is. When Goliath comes on the scene, you think back to this.
Absolutely.
Goliath is in a way the alter ego of Samson.
You're absolutely right. I think one of the messages of Torah is, no matter how big you are, there's someone going to be bigger.
Right.
No matter what. In fact, the Torah says, the Tanakh says there were two very tall people in the book of Samuel. Who were they? The first one was described as tall, Saul. He was, Mishachmo Lamala. But as tall as he was, get ready, there's going to be someone taller. And there was Goliath on the scene. And the bottom line is, if you base yourself completely on strength, you're not going to make it. I think that is a very, very, very major lesson. All those who base themselves completely on physical strength did not succeed. And it's an important lesson I think we all understand for the state of Israel as well. We've got to be strong. We've got to have the strongest army, and God should bless every one of them. There's no holier Jew than a member of the Israeli army. But I think everyone understands that to be a strong state, strength is not enough. We have to have a mission. We have to have a direction and all of that. I think you're absolutely right.
Jabotinsky wrote a nice book of Shimshon.
Jabotinsky, right.
He did.
By the way, it's interesting, his name.
Very, very interesting book
too. Shimshon, what does the name mean? Shimshon, we'll end with this. What does the name Shimshon mean? It either comes from the word Shamash. What is Shamash? A person who serves. His name is Shimshon because ultimately the hope was that he would serve God. Mm-hmm. I would also say that he's called Shimshon because it's a play on the word Shemesh. I'm convinced it's a play on the word sun. And the sun can beautify, and the sun can be very, very glorious. But the sun can hurt you too. If you're directly in the sun could be very injurious. And that was Shimshon. That was Shimshon. When you have that kind of strength, it can be for the good, or it could be for the bad. We're going to stop here for 2 minutes, and then we're going to do our midrash, not Estelle.